Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Colleges and universities across the country plan for some kind of traditional collegiate experience this fall. But just a month into the semester, and most students are online for classes. Last year, 9 in 10 Ohio State students attended in-person classes. This fall, just 2% are in-person, and some are struggling with the changes. Meanwhile, OSU and its counterparts across the country are working to reinvent higher education, leaving some students and their parents to wonder whether the experience is worth the cost. Beth McMurtry is a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's been covering the shift to online education. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Glad to be here.
So give us kind of a thumbnail of how colleges and universities entered in the fall and where they're kind of at this point.
Well, I mean, it's a moving target. You know, the spring pivot to emergency remote teaching affected all colleges, as you know. I mean, in March, most colleges shut down, sent their students home, and students had to basically learn remotely from their houses, and professors had to really scramble to get those classes online. I think by the end of the spring, people didn't want to fully commit as to what they were going to do in the fall. And then slowly over the summer, you heard a lot of people say, a lot of institutions say, well, you know, we want to be in person. Our students want to come back. We believe it's important to bring them back to campus. But then, you know, they're watching the coronavirus spread and not really retreat. The CDC is sending out different messages. They're looking at whether or not they can safely bring students back, space them out, and social distance them in classrooms, and so on. And then, you know, I would say by the end of June, most colleges hadn't committed really to being online. But by July and August, you started to see a lot of pivots. Now, we run a college tracker along with Davidson College that tracks about 3,000 institutions across the country, so community colleges, liberal arts colleges, large research universities. What we know as of today, roughly, is that about 27% of colleges are either fully or primarily in person. About 44% are either fully or partially online, or mostly online, I should say. And then 21% are doing something called a hybrid, which, you know, we can get into that a little bit later. So it's kind of all over the map. But one of the things that I think, you know, we need to think about is these broad groupings don't really convey what's happening on a lot of campuses. So, for example, even if students are coming back to campus, they might find that a lot of their classes are online, particularly kind of these large introductory lecture classes that that freshmen take, right? You've got 200 people. There's no way to socially distance there's no classroom large enough to socially distance everybody. Mm-hmm. So they might take their classes online. It's like I said, the ground has been shifting. So some colleges may have chosen to start in person. Chapel Hill did this in August. Mm-hmm. And then within 9 days, they had to pivot online because the virus started spreading out of control.
When they are primarily, as you mentioned, the ones that are mostly online, that 40%, were they also, did they have contingency plans to go on the ones that were fully or primarily in person, did they have contingency plans? So when you talk about pivoting, that sounds fast, but are they really that nimble?
Yes and no. I mean, it kind of depends on who you talk to within a college. I mean, I think college leaders like to convey that their institutions are very fluid and nimble and that they spent the summer, with their faculty members, giving them the tools and the training, should they need to move their classes online. You talk to professors, though, and they kind of feel like they were pulled in all directions over the summer. I mean, again, if only a few dozen institutions said early on that they were going to be online and, you know, their professors knew that going in, that means everybody else was trying to game out all options. So the yes part of that is, you know, we've been through this already in the spring. It was messy and it wasn't fun, but, you know, there was sort of a baseline that was established on a lot of campuses. You know, professors learned how to use Zoom just like the rest of us did, right? They learned how to make videos of their lectures and post them in their learning management systems, which are these things like Canvas and Blackboard, where they put a lot of their course material. So I would say that there was a baseline there, and then some additional summer training did help colleges so that it wasn't a repeat of the spring. But I'm sure if you talk to faculty members who thought that they were going to be teaching in person, only to find out 2 weeks in that they were had to move everything online, it just felt like another springtime scramble to them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about higher ed in the age of COVID-19 and the different variations on the theme of education in higher ed. My guest right now, Beth McMurtry, she's a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she's been covering this issue. Listeners, we would really like to hear from folks today that are part of the university, part of a college system, whether it's community college, OSU, private college, and what you're doing and how it's working for you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Beth, you said in spring, messy, not fun. And as universities and colleges have had to pivot back to that kind of scenario again, in some cases, you said it's messy, not fun again. It's a lot of what they went through in the spring. And my question is, but does anybody learn anything?
You know, that's a really good question. I think so. When you look at some of the surveys that came out at the end of the spring, you know, because people were trying to address this question, you see a lot of different things happening. I mean, for the most part, people feel like they got through it okay. You know, they got across the finish line. If you recall, it was about halfway through the semester. A lot of colleges were sending their students on spring break around that time when they had to quickly, send them home. So you have, you know, their calendars differ, but you have like 7 weeks left in the semester, okay? So then you kind of have to break it down. And a lot of professors were saying, what do I really need my students to learn in the last 7 weeks? And what you found there was that a lot of professors were kind of scaling back the workload on their students, making deadlines more flexible, changing up maybe the kind of assignments that they gave the students. If they could, I know professors preferred to kind of ditch these like big end of semester exams, you know, the kind that might count for 50% of your grade, mm-hmm. on the idea that students just mentally weren't, you know, up to the task of kind of taking these big exams. And there's a whole issue around kind of exam proctoring we could talk about at some point. Mm-hmm. So if you're scaling back, if you're modifying, if you're adapting, one survey I looked at coming out of the University of Georgia system, so several hundred faculty members were asked, you know, how did you think the spring went? They actually said that grades were, most of them said the grades were the same or higher than in other semesters, but they also said that they made those modifications in the spring. Now, we should note, you know, there's a reason why people called the spring an emergency remote pivot. You know, they did not emergency remote teaching. They didn't call it online education because that is not online education, right? You know, online education is well-crafted. You map your 15 weeks out in advance. You've got your tools. You've got your syllabus. You've got your curriculum. You have your strategies. This wasn't that. This was just trying, like I said, to get over the finish line.
And are you seeing or when we compare, say, the fully or primarily in-person group of 27% versus the mostly online group of 40%, is there anything of interest to note in what's happening, you know, in terms of learning and those experiences? Are they doing better when they're in person than they are online or vice versa?
So I think it's almost impossible to kind of come up with a definitive answer to that question because, you know, campuses vary, classes vary. You know, again, a 200-person introductory chemistry class is going to be different than a 15-person senior seminar, right? You could mm-hmm. probably pull the latter off a little more easily online, you know, than you could the former. And I don't know that you can – so it's not really apples to apples comparisons, too, you know, mm-hmm. classrooms aren't laboratories. We can't really test out whether this, you know, in-person class on this campus is the same as that online class on that campus.
Right.
I will say that professors have been thinking very carefully about how to replicate or recreate the classroom experience. I think in the spring, because it was so quick and dirty, it was very transactional. I'm going to post this video. You're going to watch it. You're going to do the assignment, and you're going to turn it in.
And you're going to like it.
I think they acknowledge that nobody would like it. And we can talk a little bit. I have some really interesting student survey data about what they thought about all that. But, you know, that is not learning. I mean, that's content transmission, right? I mean, a classroom setting is so much more. It's like a sense of community. It's you're chatting with your classmates. You're talking to your professor after the class. You're getting in groups and doing maybe like some active learning exercises around a table. To the extent that they can, I think professors are doing a much better job this fall, the ones that were able to prepare somewhat to be online, to replicate that experience. And so I'm optimistic that they're getting closer to that goal of face-to-face. Having said that, I think one of the challenges here as we look back, or we look back on all of this, is that unlike traditional online education, which is a choice that people make, mm-hmm. nobody chose to do this, right? Like, nobody really wants to be in their bedroom or their dorm room, you know, taking a Zoom class. No professor wants to be in their kitchen table, you know, teaching while their kids are doing virtual school, right? Mm-hmm. This is just an imperfect scenario. So I think it's a little bit hard to know whether this is going to work. And I just want to make one more point, and sure. that is, we have to think about, when we think about in-person learning this fall, what does it look like? Everybody's wearing a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Your professor might be behind plexiglass, right? You are spaced out in a classroom. You might be 10 feet from somebody. You know, who knows if you can hear the guy sitting 30 feet behind you at the mm-hmm. back of the room. And maybe you're actually, I have a feeling that a lot of classes are using technology even in the classroom for that reason, because it might actually be easier to communicate or do group work on your computer, you know, get all in a Google Doc together, right, than sit around a table, because you can't sit around that table anymore. So the in-person this fall, I think, is imperfect as well. So it's a lot to think about and a lot to consider, and I think that's why I said there's no simple answer to say, will the in-person look like or be better or worse than online this fall?
You know, too, when everybody's in person, or when it is an in-person scenario, regardless of whether it's pandemic, you know, distancing and masked situation, everybody's on the same plane. When it is remote learning, there's a myriad different scenarios for the learners. Someone
right.
might not be in their bedroom. They might be sharing a bedroom with three other people. There's all different, you know, we don't know. Everyone's coming from a different place. It seems kind of, for lack of a better word at the top of my head, unfair.
Yeah, and I think there have been a lot of conversations and a lot of self-reflection in higher education about the inequities in higher education. I mean, if you're a lower-income student, first-gen student, you're just going to have fewer resources than somebody who, you know, grew up in a wealthy neighborhood and has a big house mm-hmm. and has a top-notch high school education. You know, might be living in an apartment with multiple siblings, and you might not have your own space, and your laptop might be old. Your Wi-Fi might be glitchy. You might not want to turn your camera on if you have a Zoom class because you're embarrassed by your surroundings. So that makes you feel even more isolated. So I think there have been a lot of conversations and a lot of worry that these sort of differences and inequities that have always existed in higher education among different student groups are even more evident now. And I think a lot of people are concerned that, you know, they don't want those kids on the margins, or whatever kind of margin they're on,
mm-hmm.
to drop off, right? They want to make sure that they stay in school, which is the big ask right now, I think.
And then one other issue that we can get into more deeply later, but is community college enrollments. I thought that a lot of students, particularly those questioning the value, you know, the intrinsic value of taking an online course at the likes of Ohio State or wherever it might be, might pivot to community colleges. But I see in an article inside Higher Ed that community college enrollments dropped this fall. Now, it may be just because the, you know, pivoting is one thing, but making that big of a decision change is another. But still.
Yeah, I found that really interesting as well, because typically when times, so you've got the pandemic, and like you said, students wanting to get the biggest bang for their buck, you would think, well, maybe I'm not going to go to the $30,000 a year college. I'm going to go take a few community college classes for a few thousand.
Yeah.
Right? But, and then, you know, you've got the other group that typically goes to community college, which is our like adult learners, mm-hmm. right? When times are tough, when the economy is bad, like it is now, they go back to school and they get a degree maybe in a different trade. I think, and I'm speculating here, what you're finding is that people are so unsure.
Yeah.
And if people have lost their jobs, so like if you're an adult learner and you've lost your job, you don't have money to go back to school. If you're the child of somebody who lost their job, and again, community colleges tend to attract a disproportionate number of low-income students and students of color. And we know that communities of color have gotten really hard hit during the pandemic. So economically, if you're not in a place to actually pay money to go to college, you might simply not go to college at all. I think that's what's happening there. But I was surprised, like you were. I thought that you'd see more of a shift to community colleges as well.
We are talking about higher ed in the age of COVID-19. My guest is Beth McMurtry. She is a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We have others joining us, including the senior director of academic advising at Ohio State. So stay with us. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you if you're attending college in one way or another, if you teach, if you are staff. Give us a call. Tell us what it's like. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Despite the best efforts of colleges across the country, many students are now back online for classes. But unlike the experience of the abrupt shutdown in the spring, instructors and professors had time to prepare an online curriculum that could work for everyone. But many students and their parents still wonder whether the experience is worth the cost. Still with us is Beth McMurtry. She's a senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Amy Triboni is the Senior Director of Academic Advising at Ohio State. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
And Noeline McIlvenna is President of the Wright State University Chapter of the American Association of University Professors. She teaches American History at Wright State. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Noeline, what is Wright State doing this semester? Give us a thumbnail.
We are mostly online. We were one of the places where the professors had a choice, all except the nursing professors. Those who taught clinical had to go. But the rest of the professors had a choice, and most, 70% at least, chose online. Some classes, of course, are still in real life. Labs, theater and music, particularly, most of those professors chose to teach on campus. But most of us are learning this new technology and muddling through as best we can.
How's it going?
Well, it is much better than the spring, I think, as Beth was saying earlier. We had the summer to learn the nuances of the various types of software and to study even the pros and cons of teaching synchronous, you know, where every week you meet them and broadcast live versus asynchronous, you know, just recording videoed lectures so that they could watch it in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pros and cons for each of those. And again, you know, as she said, trying to decide not just for particular disciplines what might be better, but also for those different kinds of classes, the very large versus the small. You know, so that's really, we had all summer to try and do that. And so I think what's happening this fall is much better. You know, there's still some anxiety, certainly on the part of professors, you know, because you have to learn to trust the technology, learn to trust everything, your internet connection and all that kind of stuff, and have to have a plan B for when that goes out or might go out. And there's definitely more work in terms of chasing down those students who seem to be drifting away, because we have to really give it a lot. You know, there's some who just, this is not the optimal way to learn. I mean, there were always lots of students who chose online. But for many, this is not optimal. And so there's a lot more sort of one-on-one, trying to send personal emails, get in touch with these students, find out if there's a problem you can solve, just to try and keep them, you know, keep them engaged and keep them from dropping out. So it's been a very, very busy few months for professors.
Beth McMurtry, have you seen broadly as far as how professors are setting goals and achieving goals at this point and how they're trying to make it work?
Yeah, I think just to echo a couple of those points there, you know, the synchronous versus asynchronous debate is interesting. I know when a lot of professors pivoted in the spring, they had this, the initial thought was, oh, well, my class meets Tuesday, Thursday, 10 to 11, and I'm just going to keep meeting, except we'll meet on Zoom. And I think what they quickly found out is students might have laptop or Wi-Fi issues that made it really difficult to stream live. They might have child, you know, home issues, health issues.
Yeah, because everything changed at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, you could be in a different time zone. And it might not work for the professor. Again, they might have to take care of somebody. They might have kids at home. And so you saw in the spring a pivot to asynchronous, right? But that can be a little alienating, I think, for undergraduates, you know, particularly like, you know, first and second year students who are still kind of getting used to college. What you see now maybe is a bit of a blend where a lot of professors might say videotape a short lecture and have students kind of watch that on their own and do whatever the work is associated with that. And then they'll have a live discussion with the students. So they want, if they do have the synchronous option, which I think a lot of students like, it kind of anchors them. It, you know, you can see everybody, you can talk to your professor. There are ways, you know, you can do breakout rooms and work with other students. It kind of gives you a sense of the classroom. So a lot of professors, if they're doing that, they're using it for group work, for discussion, not for like a Zoom lecture, which is deadly, right? And, you know, again, that's something they tried in the spring too. I'm just going to lecture for 50 minutes and you're going to watch me. And that didn't work either. So I think you're seeing a lot more nuance to that in terms of how some of these classes are crafted.
And Amy Triboni, what are you hearing from students and parents about full-time, about the whole virtual learning, synchronous versus asynchronous prospects? I mean, are some students dropping out?
Sure. We're definitely hearing more students and parents concerned about managing just the complexities of such an environment. And we still have a large number of students who have some in-person course components, but then are also taking the rest of their classes virtually. And so trying to balance being in a specific place at a time and then needing to find a place to study has been one of the challenges that we've tried to help students address by making specific spaces available to students who need to study on campus or conduct their online courses from campus because they might be a commuter student. We have had some students drop classes and have also extended the drop deadline for this fall so that students can make that decision even later in the term than we would normally allow, because we understand that navigating this, understanding how you're doing in the class, and being able to make a good decision about remaining in it or not might take students a little bit longer.
And as far as what we were talking about, I mentioned earlier about 2% are in person at Ohio State right now, right?
Yeah, it's actually a little smaller than that in terms of students who are fully in person.
Okay.
We have about, let me grab that stat for you. We have about 69% of students who are doing hybrid, which would be a combination of in-person and online.
Okay.
And then the other 30% are in all distance learning.
And that means that they're not probably in Columbus, they're not on campus.
It Correct. Some of them are actually still living on campus, either in our residential housing provided by the university or in adjacent areas to campus. But we also have students who are studying from around the world. And to the point of students and synchronous versus asynchronous classes, it's obviously a great challenge for our students who are in different time zones. We have a significant population of students from China, and they're 12 hours different from us. So if they're taking a 2 p.m. class at Ohio State, they're doing that at 2 a.m. Mm. And so we recognize that that prevents them from fully engaging potentially and being able to be their best student self.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That is Amy Tribone. She is Senior Director of Academic Advising at Ohio State. Also with us, Nolene Mikkelvina. She is an American History Professor and Chapter President of the American Association of University Professors at Wright State University. And also with us, Beth McMurtry. She's a Senior Writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We'd like to hear from our audience, if you're listening and someone you know. If you're in classes, if your child's in classes or doing studying remotely, give us a call. Tell us what it's like. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Beth McMurtry, can we talk about the kind of intrinsic value of a college education? The part that I liked. I mean, I liked college. I loved college. You know, I wanted to get that journalism degree and I've made a career out of it. But I also just really liked college and I liked meeting new people and having that whole experience of being, I was at a Big Ten university. And, you know, I'm just wondering where's that going to go at this point? Because, well, we just, is it going to change?
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about that and to talk about that and to and when you have this kind of I hate to use the word experiment because nobody wants to be here, but just this strange alternate reality where kind of you can't have the full college experience. It really makes you think about what does it mean to be in college, or what does it mean to be a college student. I mean, yes, you can get a lot from an online class. You can if it's well structured, get a sense of community there, and you can kind of build rapport and connections. You can certainly learn in an online class, right? There's plenty of evidence of that. But what about those hallway conversations, right? Those casual interactions with your professors or your classmates? What about, you know, service learning opportunities you might do? What about events on campus you might have, or just getting together with people in in the dormitory? I think a lot of people are really appreciating maybe that, you know, college is kind of a combination of all of those things together, right? And that the learning that students experience pulls from all of those different things. It's not just you go to class to learn and then you leave class and you have fun, right? It's a real mixture of things. I should say too, like I'm experiencing this not only as a reporter, but also as a parent. I mean, my son is a freshman at college right now, and he's just experienced the gamut in the first 6 weeks. They opened the campus. He had a mixture of hybrid classes in person and online. The virus went out of control. After a week of classes, they shut everything down. They moved, you know, students out. Everybody went online. It's been that way for about 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. They now feel like they've gotten the virus under control, and they're bringing everybody back to campus. And he has no idea, like, which of those classes will go back to being in person and which will stay online. And, you know, I watch him on his Zoom classes, and I think to myself, this is not at all what my freshman year looked like, you know, when I was in college. I feel sorry for these kids. I mean, I do think that colleges are trying their best, and professors really, really care about their students, and they're trying their best to make sure those connections are there, and because they're lifelines for a lot of students right now. It might be the only thing they have that kind of represents college.
Well, and Nolene Mikkelvina, what about, you know, your colleagues, you and your colleagues? I mean, there's got to be an emotional thing going on there as well that definitely affects the quality of the education. I mean, people that go into to become educators, they're doing it partly because they love to teach.
Right. And so there is this anxiety that what we're doing, you know, may or may not be working. What I'm finding from my colleagues is just, yeah, it's the hardest semester they've ever done, whether it's their first or they're in their 20th year, because you're doing what you normally do, and then plus, as I said, trying to make emotional connections by writing more individually to students, by thinking through everything you've ever done again, rethinking it, how can we make this better, more real, you know. I was just spending this morning trying to think of new ways to present stuff that would have been so easy before. If I turn on my whiteboard, can I show these political cartoons about women's suffrage, which was today's topic?
Mm-hmm.
How can I get the whole class to interact the way they would if we were in the room? And I, you know, I'm just going to try. We use the chat box a lot. The students seem much more comfortable chatting, if you like, texting in their responses than mm-hmm. speaking mm-hmm. and sort of adjusting to that. And so you're reading a chat box as you talk, watching for those questions.
Which is very distracting. And tell me, I'm speaking from experience doing what I do.
Yeah. So, and then the others, the profs I know who are in person, you know, I have a friend who's teaching a class of 17 in a room spaced for 350,
right?
For the spacing to make sure. And I asked her, I said, what kind of dynamic is that? And she just sort of laughed, you know, ironically, like, oh. But you know, you just kind of do your best. And I'm actually sort of happy. My first papers came in last week. And although there were more that missed the deadline than usual,
mm-hmm.
certainly, you know, the rest had really done good work. And I went, oh, that's kind of gratifying to see that, you know, maybe they're not losing anything here or not much. Not
mm-hmm.
a, you know, they're reading the materials and they're able to, and this was an empathetic exercise where they had to write a piece of historical fiction, pretend you're a person in that time. And they really, really did a good job. And I'm talking about a class of 40. So clearly some of it's working. And then, you know, whereas I used to have maybe 10% that would sort of drift away
mm-hmm.
and you would try and go find them. Now it's more like, you know, it's closer to 20% who didn't do it on time. And I'm sort of trying to contact what's going on. Do you have a problem? Let me know. I think most of us are just letting deadlines go, you know, or are much more lenient about those. But, you know, just show me that you're doing the work, even if it's on a different time frame.
But then I wonder, you know, when you, and I'm not trying to sound, I feel like I sound like a hardcore, and I'm not, but if you're letting deadlines go, where's that piece of the experience going?
Yes. And so, and, you know, I said at the beginning of the class, deadlines are very important.
Yeah.
And so most of them didn't meet them, right? It's just that when those who don't, you don't go as hard on them as you might in a normal year, you know, and you try and find out what's going on. And we even have, you know, the college credit plus students in here. So that's really, I worry about them. You know, they are still high school students trying to do college work, which is normally a big adjustment. And now they're trying to do it in this new Zoom world. And I fear for them. I'm not sure it's the best semester for high schoolers to be taking college.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I was interested in what you said to Beth, you know, about the all that extra stuff that is university.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why so many went back to campus all over. And that's why you had these breakouts everywhere. It's because students really want that. They want the whole, they want the party, mm-hmm. but they want everything. They want all that study groups together in dorm and all that. But in the end, of course, that's led to enormous breakouts in some of these campuses. So that's the catch. But it's certainly why, you know, the students went back, I think, and my parents allowed them to go back. They didn't want to spend 6 more months with their parents. And they, but they also, you know, they understand that for many of them, that's good learning conditions. So, yes, you know, certainly for some students, this is going to be lesser. And there's nothing really we can do about that except try to mitigate it in every which way we can think of.
Well, Nolene McIlvenna, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Nolene
McElvenna. Good luck to everybody.
Nolene McElvenna is an American history professor and chapter president of the American Association of University Professors at Wright State University. Still with us, Beth McMurtry, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Amy Triboni, senior director of academic advising at Ohio State. We'll continue our conversation about what's different, what's the same, and how higher ed's working in the age of COVID-19. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how students, professors, and administrators are working through this COVID semester at American colleges and universities. Still with us, Beth McMurtry, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Amy Triboni is senior director of academic advising at OSU. Roya Hijozi is president of undergraduate student government at OSU. Welcome to the show, Roya.
Hi, thank you.
You were part of the push to get a pass, no pass grading option for students. Why did you determine that this was important?
Yeah, definitely. So the undergraduate student government really believed that a lot of the issues and disparities that students experienced during the disruption of spring semester really are still continuing to happen now. So we know that a lot of students are unemployed. We know that students are still experiencing different issues such as housing insecurity, food insecurity. Students have households and family members who are experiencing COVID-19, and that really has huge impacts in the ways that students are able to progress through their degree. So we believe that offering that would be really important for students this semester, as a lot of the difficulties from last semester still exist.
How are you reaching out to your constituents?
Yeah, so we're utilizing a lot of different ways. So we are really trying to use social media a lot now because that's really been a way for students to stay connected to each other. We continue to have different platforms such as our public cabinet meetings and general assembly meetings where students can join in and come talk to us. We also have office hours for undergraduate students to come speak to different members of our student government leadership team. We like to send out surveys and also have town halls for students to attend, and that's really how we're able to get a pulse of the student issues and student concerns that we continue to advocate for.
You know, I was not really plugged into student government when I was at, you know, university back 100 years ago, so I'm just kind of wondering, do you feel like maybe students are more plugged in now because of the remote situation, or what's your sense?
Yeah, I think students really are. I think students are starting to maybe experience more issues than they may have in the past, and they're really trying to find different spaces in which they can advocate for themselves or feel advocated for. So I really think that more students are starting to utilize student government to really feel heard and feel that they can get their concerns to the university.
Amy Triboni, what do you think about the impact of pass, no pass going forward on the how a university is rated and what the value is?
Sure. And I want to acknowledge that undergraduate student government, and Roya included, did a really impressive job of helping our faculty senate understand the difficulties that students are facing right now and the challenges that have not gone away, even as we continue through COVID-19. We do have some concerns about students using pass, non-pass. The rule is different for us this semester, and we're amongst a smaller number of schools who are offering pass, non-pass grade options as a way of supporting students. So in spring, it was pretty common for an institution to have an alternate grade scheme that helped protect the GPA and focus more on learning than on grade points and GPA points. But for fall, there's a relatively small number of institutions who have an alternate grade scheme in place. And so for students who are continuing on to graduate or professional programs, we want to make sure that they're consulting with an advisor to ensure that they're taking classes in the best grading modality for their future plans, while also acknowledging that they need to make decisions about the current state. So I think we've been really successful in getting our webpage up for Pass Non-Pass and getting information out to advisors. And so we're looking forward to helping students make those difficult decisions.
And Beth McMurtry, any sense about, you know, as Amy said, it's a relatively small number of colleges and universities that are going with Pass No Pass. Any sense about how that fits into the greater scheme going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, and I would just, echo everything that Amy and Roy said about why students might want it and why professors or administrators might urge caution, you know, needing to get into graduate school. I've heard concerns about, you know, if you need to maintain a certain GPA to keep a scholarship, you might want to take advanced classes, you know, within a particular discipline, and you might need to show that you got a certain grade in a prior class.
I will say
that I think sometimes, I think, you know, obviously, like they said, Pass No Pass is pretty common in the spring for obvious reasons. If this is the new normal for, like, perhaps an entire academic year, I do think that's why colleges are putting the brakes on. One thing I'm seeing, I would say that Pass No Pass is a little bit of a blunt instrument, right? So one thing I'm seeing is that professors are trying to figure out ways to give students grace, to give students flexibility, so to try to mitigate some of the issues that Roya talked about with stresses and work and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they might, you know, get rid of, again, that test at the end of the semester that's 50% of your grade. They might make it open book, right? So it's more about the learning, and rather than having you proctored with some, you know, camera watching you in your bedroom. You might reduce the number of assignments. They might put more emphasis on group work or projects. These are some of the things that I'm hearing from professors who are mindful of, again, all of the stresses that students are going through, but trying to figure out ways to kind of, you know, return to a semblance of normal within the classroom structure without, you know, necessarily going all the way to Pass No Pass.
Yeah, and Roya Hijazi, what's your sense about that, and students, what's the tipping point for them in making that choice at this point?
Yeah, I think really for students, it's feeling that you've reached a point in the semester in which some factor or facet of your life has not allowed you to be able to progress in the class in a way that you have previously expected. Students are really struggling a lot from a lot of outside factors in their lives. And I think that once that fear sets in and once that distraction sets in any degree, it's really hard to feel like you could see the end. And I'll also add, too, I think it's really important. I think that universities are truly overestimating the extent to which many faculty members are supporting students right now. While I recognize that there are a lot of faculty members who are doing great work and really trying their hardest to give students grace, I wouldn't say that that's necessarily a blanket statement. I think that's also why a lot of students are struggling right now, and a reason why a lot of students really do want Pass No Pass, because I don't think that that's something that's really across the board right now.
It's got to be so different, Beth McMurtry, between small schools and Big Ten universities like Ohio State, just these big, giant universities, the difference.
Yeah. Are you talking about sort of what in-person or online class might look like?
Yeah. I mean, when you only have 1,000 kids in the whole school versus, you know, schools where there's 500 kids in a class, which I experienced myself, it's a big difference anyway.
Sure. I mean, just, you know, the most immediate thing is you can probably bring everybody back to campus and create something of a bubble. It doesn't always work. I mean, there are colleges that tried it and then the virus spread and they had to send people home or go online. And then, you know, you're looking at class sizes that maybe never get above 20. You could probably have a socially distanced in-person class like that, or you could have a vibrant Zoom seminar like that. So I think, yeah, with large state universities, I mean, it's a real struggle for students and professors alike to kind of figure out an online equivalent or a hybrid equivalent. I mean, one of the things that, getting to this issue of hybrid, that I've noticed, and I reported a piece over the summer when I started hearing all of this buzz about hybrid, high flex. It seemed like, you know, this is a thing that a lot of universities were trotting out to be all things to all people. And the idea was that, you know, you could put cameras in the classroom, you could put mics in the classroom, and then you would split the students. And so half of your students would be beaming in and looking at the classroom online, and the other half would be in there. So you might have a big class, but, you know, only a portion of the students show up and then they spread out. But as that professor was talking about earlier, that's really tricky for a teaching environment, right? Because you're looking at your screen, seeing if anybody's got, like, a question through chat. The
yeah.
students are coming online. Maybe they can't hear the students in the back of the classroom. You know, I mean, if you've a lot of institutions don't have the money to kind of mic up everything, and they might just have one microphone next to your podium as the instructor. So if a student in the back is saying something, you either have to repeat it or yeah. the person online misses it. So very different dynamic.
Amy Triboni, I'm wondering from you, when is there a tipping point? I guess for one thing, are there enough academic advisors at Ohio State to deal with this whole new category of issues? And further, is there a tipping point when an academic advisor says, you know what, you need more than an academic advisor. You need counseling. There's stresses here. We need to, I don't know. I don't know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if the job has changed.
For sure. Those are great questions. I mean, I would say that it would be very hard to have enough academic advisors to cover all of the normal circumstances that students might need support with. And, you know, we just have extra needs during this time that students are identifying. Advisors, I kind of think of them as like a concierge service. So advisors can do a lot to help a student and are a primary contact for them and connection to the institution, but we work really closely with other areas of campus. So if a student is experiencing difficulties with technology, we're working with the Office of Distance Education and e-learning. If they need to quarantine or isolate, we're making sure they get registered through a specialized process with our Student Life Disability Services so that they have a letter and some additional information they can take to professors to ask for, you know, maybe a more lenient deadline or for materials in another format because they won't be able to come to class for a certain period of time. We're constantly referring students to our mental health resources, which have been increasing and growing at Ohio State, including our Counseling and Consultation Services Office, as well as our Wellness Center. And we have a Buckeye PAL line, which is a peer access line that students can call if they just need somebody to talk things through. So while these might not always be quite adequate, we are continuously updating our services. And I'm actually in the process of hiring 4 academic advisors to work on my team and support anywhere that we identify a gap in advising. So that could be a gap due to a vacancy, or it could be a situation where we're helping to support the processing and conversations about pass non-pass with each student so that they're making the best possible decision.
Roya Hijazi, does it feel like this, they're getting at it, that they're moving in the right direction? And with all the changes, are you hearing from students that this just isn't worth it?
Yeah, I think it really does depend. I think some students are able to find support from different spaces, especially through advising and through the different resources offered on campus. But I think definitely for some students, especially getting closer to the middle of the semester, there's definitely a lingering fear and also like a sense of hopelessness right now. I think students are just becoming really exhausted and lacking a lot of motivation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that not just comes from being in school, but really from the state of the world and so many factors.
Right.
But yeah, I really do think that there are a lot of resources out there. But even taking that first step to figure out what resources you need and who to confide in and who to go to can sometimes be really difficult for students as well.
And so you're saying that, yeah, they are moving in the right direction, but no, I mean, there's more. I'm wondering what more could be done. And we only have a few seconds, but you're looking mm-hmm. for more?
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking really for more support from faculty members, really trying to understand the issues that students are going through, and also just from the university at large, I'm really trying to continue to uplift the student voice and student concerns, and really understand and respect the urgency of the concerns that students are bringing to the table.
Well, we'll continue to follow this. In the meantime, Roya Hijazi, president of OS Ohio State's undergraduate student government, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Amy Travone, senior director of academic advising at OSU, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Beth McMurtry, thanks for all your time today. Senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Ed. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matt Rand, our intern, Bobby Gerberic. Actually, he's our assistant producer now. Video production by Nick Payne and board operation by Herb Howenstein and Scott Good. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.